So, one of the most underappreciated parts of life, especially for a guy sitting in this room, don't always appreciate how important it is the value of role models. Sometimes guys ask me, I'm leaving yeshiva, which svarim should I take with me back home so I can be caught up on all the latest chidushim or all the latest chidushim? You know what? Chidushim come and go. A lot of good svarim out there. I know a lot of people with a lot of svarim in their bookshelves and haven't been opened in a while, and you pick them up and you're in their house and they're collecting some dust and you open them up and there's this awkward crack when the pages crack and they haven't really been opened. So, don't think that if you come back with a lot of books in the library, a lot of books in your backpack, all of a sudden you're a big time luchachin, you've made it, you're nowhere close. Now you got to make sure you're going to learn the svarim. Actually going to use the svarim. So role model is a little more important than svarim sometimes. And I tell people sometimes, as crazy as it sounds, like if they don't tell the Rosh Yeshiva I told you this, they're going to fire me from Gush and tell me to go teach in the other yeshiva. But it is important to take pictures. You have to get off of the internet today. Of your favorite rabbis, and we know who that is. And hang them up on your wall at night so that when you're looking up, you can get inspiration from my mugshot. I can recommend the best pictures if you want. But seriously, people will inspire you. Some of you have gone to my house, you can walk into my room and there's 6 pictures on the wall. Rav Lichtenstein, Rav Amital, Rav Soloveitchik, and 3 grandparents of mine who were big Talmid Chachamim. One was actually Gadol Hador. And just, those are my people. Those are the people I think you can look at. So you don't have to have role models. Rav Lichtenstein or Aaron Lichtenstein once told us that when you have moral challenges in life, don't think about abstractly how, what's right, what's wrong. Mind plays tricks on you. When you have real needs and you feel pressured and psychologically vulnerable, all of a sudden everyone's an Einstein. Everyone becomes a moral theorist. Oh, this is the moral choice and that's the moral choice. And I know the real because you're just shooting the arrow and then drawing the target. A lot of times in life you shoot the arrow and then you draw the target. You give yourself an answer you want because it's easy. And then you draw the target all right. Say, well, bullseye, you got the right answer. It's really important to find the target. Have no moving goalposts. Fix targets in life, what's right, what's wrong. And it's very hard when you're under pressure, you're feeling insecure. You're under pressure. Every sin is not just a physical lust, but you feel some pressure, some need, some desire. So it's really important to ask yourself not what's right or what's wrong, but what would so-and-so do? How would so-and-so respond? A lot of you are walking through anger now, anger issues at this age. A lot of anger in you because the world doesn't yet make sense. A lot of frustration. You have a lot of needs and wants, and it's hard for you to always realize them because there are other people in your life, parents, rebbes, friends, whatever, and it's hard for you to find that space between your desires and your ability to execute your desires and the limitations of this world. Once you grow a little bit older, you find your space. You settle in, okay, this is what I want, and I'll try my best to accomplish, and I will get certain things, I won't get everything, and I'll be happy for the things I have, and the anger subsides, but there's a lot of anger, a lot of temper. Ask yourself, really, at this age, the next 5-6 years, not whether you should or shouldn't be getting angry, because part of the anger is you lose your cool, and you can't ask yourself questions like that, because you're in no place to make moral judgments when you're angry. So the best way to do it is say, how would so-and-so respond if they were angry? How would I respond if they were in the room? Because that makes it real and palpable. How would so-and-so respond if they were felt jealous? Would they be jealous? If they were petty, would they be petty? Just find real traits. Don't just ask yourself, like, the big vices, the greed, the lust, the sexual desire. Even sometimes it's the little stuff that really weighs us down. Pettiness, jealousy, small-mindedness, selfishness, laziness. Those are the things that you really need to clean up to be a better person, a better Oved Hashem. I did that a lot in my life, and it was very helpful to me to find moral role models. People that I could ask myself, when Yosef HaTzadik was such a big tzadik, he holds off Eishes Potifar. Chazal tell us that, just learned the Daf Yomi two, three weeks ago, every day she would dress in new clothing, one set of clothing in the morning, one set of clothing, who could stand such seduction, who could stand such temptation, especially when you're alone, you're feeling abandoned, you've been spewed out by your parents, you've been betrayed by your brothers. Of course you finally want someone to figuratively and literally wrap their arms around you and embrace you and make you feel better and special. And Chazal say, he looks at the window and he sees Yaakov. For all of his righteousness and for all of his piety, even Yosef needs that role model to see Yaakov. So it's really, 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 like sometimes people ask me, why should my son stay in yeshiva? Why should he stay Shana Bet? Does he have more to gain Shana Bet? I said, to be honest with you, you can have books anywhere, you can find a shiur anywhere, maybe the quantity will be dip, but role models. So much in life is role models. People that you see, and it doesn't have to be frontal, and it doesn't have to be just people that you meet and say, you know what? The more good people you hang around with in your life, the better, by osmosis, these traits rub off on you. I can look back at my formative year, I just tried to hang around with good people. And it doesn't have to be a lot of conversation, it could just... I had some of the boys over for a barbecue yesterday. Some of the boys were quoting some of the things I told them in the interviews that I gave. So very often a boy will ask me, tell me about relationships in yeshiva between Rebbeim and Talmidim. And I'll say, well, tell me about the relationships you really gained from in high school. Did you gain from relationships in which you sat in a room with a Rebbe or an older figure repeatedly for 2 hours a day or 2 hours every 2-3 days and talked about life and worked through things? That's not the environment in this yeshiva. This yeshiva is really tilted towards learning, tilted towards time in the base medrash with your peers in the classroom. So I don't think this is a yeshiva for people that envision their year as very, very frequent, 2-3 times a week, long conversations. And no, I'm not way demeaning that importance. Some people really want that. But I feel where we excel is we've got just really good role models on display here, whether it's Rebbeim, whether it's older boys, whether it's Kollel. I mean, we just took account the other day, there are over 100 married people learning in the Kollel. Yeah, it's a lot. And during Corona, you didn't see many of them, but that's, you know, probably a good 95 more than most frameworks. It's a tremendous amount if you see and if you're with all those people. So you need role models in life, especially when you have to make it through difficult situations. Especially when you have to make it through difficult situations. So who are Kalev and Yeshua's role models? Because these are two people that stand tall. Classic, quintessential, avoiding public pressure. You talk about public pressure. You're outnumbered 10 to 2. And everyone's panicking. And all these other so-called leaders are swaying the people's hearts. And it's so easy to join the mob. And two people make a stand. How do you make a stand? How do you get up and define yourself and say, I'm not buckling. I know what's right. Moral clarity. I'm going down with the ship. I'm not going to let my mind be clouded by your moral relativism, but your moral disintegration. What's happening to these people? So for Yeshua, it's pretty obvious. You know, that's why there's no sources about Yeshua. If you interviewed Yeshua, who's your role model? Like, of course, Moshe Rabbeinu. Like, is that even a question? It's Moshe Rabbeinu. Haven't you been paying attention? We've seen Yeshua 3 times already in his cozy relationship with his Rebbe, which is going to get a lot cozier after the Meraglim. We've seen him in Parshas B'Shalach, Moshe turns to Yeshua and says, we have to fight. I'm busy. I'm the davener. You lead the army. B'char lanu anashim. Go get the soldiers. Go get the officers. I'll go up top. You lead the battle. You have to trust someone. High level of trust to delegate such authority. This is even before Har Sinai. So this is a very impressionable people. Very often it's hard to delegate until you build up trust. So I hope, let's say, for argument's sake, you have enough trust, let's say, in me after a year, I say, you know what, you know, go to that person. I say, in order for the target to send me to that person, yeah, it's probably someone I can trust. He's not just sending me to someone. But if you don't know me from Adam, I make a recommendation. How do you know? So recommendations and delegation, they're only as powerful and valid as the trust level in the person referring. So Moshe, a few weeks after Yitzias Mitzrayim, is already delegating and expecting people to lay their lives on the line for someone they hardly know. Yeshua. But they know him because they know him through Moshe. And we don't really see Moshe and Yeshua before then, but it's pretty obvious that when Moshe tells Yeshua, Yeshua has street cred through Moshe, because he's Moshe's Talmud. And then Parshas Ki Tisa, just talk about a lonely man of faith, one person standing under the mountain waiting for his Rebbe, while the entire camp is erupting in this orgy of screaming, shouting, killing, and sexual, and he's just standing by the mountain waiting for Moshe. That's how loyal he is, and that's how resolved he is not to join the masses. And then last week's parsha, he's worried about Moshe's dignity. Moshe isn't necessarily in touch with what's happening with Eldad or Medad, and they're running around spewing this unsolicited prophecy. And Yeshua, very vigilant, very protective of Moshe, maybe less, let's say, less perspective than Moshe. Moshe says, you know what? That should be the biggest problem, as we talked about last week. But we already know Moshe and Yeshua. And in this week's parsha, it hits a climax. I mean, you come into your Rebbe's room, and he changes your name. That's a pretty, pretty big pass-the-baton moment. Let's say I called you in and said, okay, let's say we had a ceremony. Maybe we should start the ceremony in yeshiva. That every Shana Bet guy gets a new name. You'll now be called. Wow, that was scary. You'll now be called. We'll add a new name. It's like Chas V'Shalom, people add new names when they're sick. Transformation, new personality. You're Shana Bet now. You're going to be called. I don't want to embarrass anyone. We'll add a name. We'll add one guy's name will be, Moshe, because he's learning a lot of Torah. You'll be Moshe so-and-so, and you'll be, Torah will add to your name. That's what's happening. Talk about empowerment. Talk about confidence. Hosea comes in. We know him as Yeshua, but it's all revisionist. Until this point, he's Hosea. Vayigra Moshe el Hosea, but at least the way the Pasuk suggests, at this point, he calls him in. He says, I trust you. I know there are some tricky, dicey moments ahead, but I know, and Yeshua walks out of there beaming. Like, did I tell you I have a new name? Did I tell you what Moshe just said about me? He said that I'm Yeshua. I mean, the truth is, it's not really that arrogant, because it's not arrogant at all, because I'll say that even Yeshua was very, very humble. And he walked around still taking the name Hosea, because he didn't want people to notice. And that's why in Parshas Hazinu, the word Hosea still appears, because he still calls himself Hosea. But at least internally, he feels empowered. So if you fast forward 3 weeks later, they're all sitting on a teal, in the middle of the north, and all the Meraglim were on one side of the camp, around the campfire, gossiping, planning their rebellion, collecting the fruits, harumphing, this silly, silly idea of entering Eretz Yisrael. And Yoshua's on the other side. And what gives him strength on that summer night when they're all sitting around the campfire planning their rebellion? Moshe expects something. Moshe believes in me. Moshe expects something of me. Moshe has empowered me. When you believe in people, they tend to act up to the level of your belief. If you tell them you believe in them and you empower them and you have faith in them, they tend to act up. In high school, most of your correction was people talking down to you. How did that work out for you? You got to be in 11th grade and you didn't like it very much. When people don't talk down to you, they talk up to you and say, you know what, I expect more of you. You should rise to the occasion. You have the capabilities. Most mature people tend to rise to that level. Always believe in people and challenge them based on the beliefs. I believe in you, but you could be doing more. And you should be doing more. So that's the drama of Yeshua. There's no surprise here with Yeshua. The big surprise cameo appearance in this week's parasha, out of nowhere, rookie of the year. I mean, no one saw this coming. It wasn't even a first round draft. This is Kalev. Where does he come from? And if you read between the cracks a little bit, I mean, he's a Nasi. Let's give him his due. He's not just a commoner. But it's clear he's not as aristocratic as Yoshua. And it's clear on two fronts. A, because we really haven't heard of him before. B, listen to his name. You don't name princes after dogs. It's a commoner name. It's a person from the field, a Kalev, who is a Kalev. So all of a sudden, this is a very different feel. Now again, his mother was Miriam, so he's not exactly this common person with no heritage that I'm describing, but at least the Torah wants you to see this. The Torah wants you to see someone that has no Rebbe and no famous last name and no famous first name. And how does he succeed? And Chazal fill in the blanks. And one of the blanks Chazal filled, source number Aleph, part one. Vayalu Banegav, all the Meraglim ascend in the south, Vayavo ad Hebron. And he comes to Hebron. Wait a second. They ascend in the south and he goes to Hebron? Judah said they ascend in the south and they arrive at Hebron. Why is the arrival at Hebron articulated in singular fashion? Vayavo ad Hebron. So very famous Medrash, they all ascended the south and then went off in their own merry way. He went to Sderot and he went to Beersheba and he went there and he went to... But one man went to Hebron. Who's the one that went to Hebron? Kalev. Why did he go to Hebron? To Maris and Machpelah. Why did he go to Maris and Machpelah? To Daven at Kibri Avos. Then to ask Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, help me out here a little bit. I know I'm in for some rough patches. I know this isn't going to be easy. I know I'm going to need nerves of steel. I'm going to need a lot of discipline and courage. I have to identify. First of all, he's asking for their help. But also, he wants to identify with this. Every time you visit Kibri Avos, there are many, many layers to that experience. You get daven to Hashem at a Kibri Avos. That's just the site of spiritual elevation, and you feel like your tefillos will be enhanced by standing there. Well, you're not davening to the Kibri. You could ask the person in Shemayim to be a Melech Yosher. That's not davening to the dead person. That's asking. Or you can just visit a kever to more deeply identify with that person's life or that person's death in certain tragic cases. So a kever is a multi-layered experience. Obviously, no one's davening to anyone in Shemayim. They're davening to Hashem. They're asking the person to daven for them, or they're trying to jumpstart higher spiritual intensity. Now, very few people, I imagine, in this room are big grave visitors, present company included. I go to the grave once a year. Baruch Hashem, my parents are alive, so I don't have a yard site that I keep, but I go to graves in my Rosh Yeshiva and the people who died on Kiddush Hashem, as the Shulchan Aruch says, Erev Rosh Hashanah or Erev Yom Kippur, depending on when I have the time. But when you see people going to grave sites, don't dismiss it, don't deride it. It's a very deeply meaningful experience and may not be the experience that we pivot most of our Avodas Hashem upon. So he's at Marisa Machpela, Kalev. And he davens. And there's a contrast between Yehoshua and Kalev. Because Yeshua has a cozy relationship with Moshe, and Kalev doesn't. And let's talk about this contrast in two different ways, two different angles. Number one, forget the fact that Kalev goes to Hebron for a moment. It could have been a million other ways that Kalev helped himself. We'll find other ways for Kalev to help himself. The point is that Kalev becomes a hero, and in some ways surpasses Yeshua because he receives a double portion, Shechem, in Eretz Yisrael. Kalev receives, or the land that he traveled, not Shechem, the land that he traveled to, despite the fact that he's not aristocracy, despite the fact that he wasn't raised in a yeshiva, or at least we don't see that in the same way that Yeshua is, he doesn't have a relationship with Moshe. I think there are a lot of boys your age that when they start to grow and dream, and ask themselves, can I really be a Talmud Chacham? Can I really be something great in Torah? Can I really accomplish something beyond just coming here, coming in, coming out? Can I really be a game changer? So a lot of times people are intimidated just because it's really intimidating, because you have to spend many, 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 many years with a lot of hard work. But no one in this yeshiva got where they are through any other route. No one here is, some people are really bright, some people are less bright. I've been around the block enough times to tell you that most of the people in the Beis Medrash is because they worked and worked and worked and worked, which means if you work and work and work and work, it's your level, you can also become a Talmud Chacham. The only thing separating you from becoming a Talmud Chacham is the willingness to put in the hours. It has nothing to do with how many brain cells you have in your head and nothing to do with your background. I've been around the yeshiva system long enough to see brilliant, scintillating intellects who flamed out because they didn't have discipline or desire, and average yeoman intellects who just worked and worked and worked and worked and worked and became talmidei chacham. So don't excuse yourself or exempt yourself because I'm not Einstein or because I'm not that person. I don't have that brain capacity. It's nothing to do with brain capacity. But there's another time I think people sometimes, they say, you know what? I could understand if my last name was fill in the blank. My last name was Soloveitchik. If my last name was Liechtenstein. If my last name was Cutler. Oh, okay, that makes sense. I'm an insider. I was raised on the inside. I have family, uncles, parents, grandparents. But my last name, no fill in the blank. And my father, he's just a lawyer. He's just a plumber. He's just a banker. Like, I'm not an insider. I'm an outsider. And we all know that insiders make it and outsiders don't make it. And the story of Kalev is really not true. Insiders make it. And probably insiders make it with greater frequency just because it's in their blood and it's in their training. It's not a question of we award them more. It's just they grew up on it. And if you're looking, as you always have to be looking, what do you want to accomplish by being here in yeshiva? There's got to be vision, guys. You're not going to be successful unless you have a vision-discipline sandwich. You need both. You need a lot of discipline, a lot of ability to work hard, but discipline alone will not get you to the promised land. You have to have vision. Why is it important to come in tomorrow at 8:30 or at 6, whenever you're coming in, and learn the next page in Beit Zohar? Like, what is that going to do? I'm not going to win the Nobel Prize. I'm not going to solve cancer. This isn't a degree-granting institution. Why should I be disciplined and learn another page of Beit Zohar? Okay, if I asked Rabbi Tarigan that question, you'd say to be a Talmid Chacham. What does that mean? You don't even know what it means in some cases. So I have to make it more concrete for you. Well, in 25 years, you'll be sitting in your home. You'll have children. It'll be the Shabbos table. It'll be the Pesach table. There'll be a Shiloh that will come up. What types of eyes do you want your kids looking at? The eyes of someone that has no clue, and for whom religion is just some sociological package that you keep? Or the eyes of someone that deeply, deeply lives religion and teaches them religion and answers religion? And so I'm trying to make it palpable, and that's a goal you could shoot for. Doesn't have to be the biggest Rebbe, doesn't have to be the biggest Talmid Chacham in the world. You could just be that type of father. Or, to make it even more palpable, if you have that type of father, you know what I'm referring to, and you know how you benefited from it. And if you don't have that type of father, and it's no, in any way, indictment of your parents, I don't know your parents, where they came from, what opportunities they had, what culture they came from, but you certainly know someone that had that father. You certainly know someone in your shul that had a father who was a Talmid Chacham and grew up, and isn't that something you want to give your children? It's a lot better than giving them another PlayStation or another iPhone. I mean, but to do, they have to work for it. I deeply identify with Kalev. When I was growing up and in your position, making a decision, my father's an incredible Talmid Chacham. He's been through Shas 8 times. But he wasn't a Rav. So I look back 2-3 generations before, but if I looked into my immediate surroundings, I wasn't born into a rabbinic family in terms of where I was raised. I was raised in a professional family. And so all these people alongside of me in yeshiva and smicha, this one had this last name and that one had that last name, and I just had a regular last name. It didn't mean anything. And I said, well, it doesn't make a difference. It doesn't have to mean anything. Maybe I can make it mean something one day. But it doesn't have to mean anything. It's just my last name. And I'm going to work hard the same way. Kalev didn't have no one had a last name. I'm sure didn't have a last name either. I'm just using a metaphor. But Kalev didn't have a first name. He wasn't part of it. He didn't have a Rebbe. So part of the message of Kalev is outsiders get there. It's the same business. It's just working. It's all meritocracy. How hard do you want to work? And I'm trying to make this decision that you have to take over the next couple months and over the next couple weeks, and the guy, as you're growing, make it as existential as possible. You're deciding your future. You are directly impacting the you that you can't see because he's 20 years in the future. But there are people that are saying, please, please be successful in yeshiva. I need you to be that type of person. It's your wife, it's your children, it's your grandchildren. If you're not successful now, you're shortchanging them. So it's about raising the volume level, the decibel level of what you're going through. You're no longer kids. You're no longer on the sidelines. Which classes do I go to? Who are the rabbis? This is your life, and you have started to write the chapters. And every page you write will determine the ensuing chapters. You can't always rewrite chapters. And whatever pages you write now, those will affect the chapters you write later. And this is a very, very existentially meaning parsha, because you have people that have to write those chapters, and Yeshua, he's given a pen and paper, and he's given writing lessons from Moshe. Kalev has no writing lessons. Kalev has to write that book on his own. The second message of Kalev, vis-a-vis Yeshua, is not just that he's an outsider who doesn't have the luxury of a Moshe Rabbeinu in his life, but that he's able to look to his past and find the people that he deeply identifies with and use that as inspiration. I hope that part of living here, looking outside, getting up every morning, looking over the mountains, davening Kabbalah Shabbos, you're literally living in the backyard of our avos. And it has to be different. It's not like you're in Johannesburg learning, or you're in Montana. What we're hoping, what would happen if we just found a beautiful ranch in Montana and built a yeshiva there? And everyone have a nice time, plenty of space, plenty of sunsets. It's not Montana. This is Eretz Avos. This is where our Avos built history. Right here, these steps. I don't know if the Eretz Avos, you can trace Avram steps, but it's clear this whole area. You can't get to Yerushalayim from Hebron unless you pass through the ridge of the Gush, the mountain ridge of the Gush. So somewhere in this area, history unfolded. And by living here in this land, and living here, I think, during a year that was doubly existential, A, because of Corona, which means that everyone took it more real. This is real. People are dying. This is real life. This is historical. You'll tell your children about this. People are working hard for your benefit to ensure your safety. But also the war. It lasted a week. It didn't really hit us here, but you were in this country. You knew what happened. And all of a sudden, this is life and death. To be a Jew and to live in this land is not just snapshots and Instagram and falafel and celebrating Israel and I love Israel. And it's Are you willing to put your mouth, your money where your mouth is? Are you willing to really make a difference, even if it means you have to sacrifice for it? Now, hopefully the sacrifices won't be too stiff, but it means something when you have to sacrifice, at the very least, your safety for it, because you've bought it with something that's meaningful to you. So Kalei doesn't have Moshe Rabbeinu, but he looks back. I told you at my Kalei moment, when I was around your age, I look back without iterating who my grandparents were. I had some pretty chashuv. I imagine that every single person in this room can find someone in their family that did something exceptionally great within the world of religion. If you just go back far enough, that's just the way our... You can probably go back, I imagine most of you, if you went back 3 or 4 generations, 5 generations, you could probably find that person who was really Moser Nefesh for Torah, really Moser Nefesh for the community, if not earlier. So you may not have that father, you may not have that Rebbe, but you still have people in your past that you can look back to and deeply, deeply identify with them. And hopefully this year is making not just the Avos, but past. Hopefully, if you ask me what this year is meant to do, it's meant to create, I call it different words, I'll use a different word now, historical elasticity. When you're young, you just grow up and you know where you live. I grew up here and this is my street and I went to this pizza shop and I went to this camp and these are my friends and it's a really, really, really small space. And part of coming to a place like Rush is broadening the space. Oh, there are Jews in Melbourne? I never knew that, said most Jews in Tibet. Oh, there are Jews in Sydney? I never knew that, said most Jews. And all of a sudden, it's not just about your central avenue where you had your restaurants and your friends and your tournaments and your it's something a little bit larger. But it's not just stretching space, it's stretching time. And you're part of some lineage of generations that have worked so hard to get to this point, and now you take your place amongst the Jews of history, and you live on this world for 80, 90, 100 years, and you will be held accountable. What did you do for the Jewish people? How did you leave the Jewish world differently? And that has to haunt you. And that has to haunt your religious drive, and that has to haunt your decision-making and your career-making and your decision of where to live-making. That has to haunt you. So there's historical elasticity, historical resonance to Kalev. And Yeshua doesn't need it. But there's something missing if you don't have it. Even if you have it. Even if you have a Rebbe slash father slash brother who can just give it to you on a silver platter. Sometimes historical perspective broadens it. If you're just listening to the Rebbe's parents and contemporaries, well, fads and trends come and go. One thing I can promise you, people didn't wear black hats 400 years ago. No, there's nothing wrong with wearing a black hat. And if that's your minhag, and if that's what you think is a better show of kavod tefillah, or a better show to uniform yourself as an Oved Hashem, it's all good. But it's a recent experience. Or someone just sent me a WhatsApp. Not known from this yeshiva, a boy from another yeshiva heard a shiur of mine. I just went somewhere for Shabbos, and the rabbi told me about all the differences between modern orthodoxy and yeshivish. What do I feel? So, oh my goodness, like, please, please don't waste your time. These are fads. They come and they go. 200 years ago, no one had a clue what these words meant. And I promise you, in 200 years, no one will have a clue either. Just focus on the absolutes and the eternals. Focus on Yerush Shamayim. Focus on Talmud Torah. Focus on Chesed. Please, please, if I have to hear the word modern Orthodox, I'm going to shoot myself. Shoot me now. Who cares? It's stupid. It's stupid. These are just communities that band together, but common values. You need to know which will you go to. Imagine yourself on a desert island serving Hashem. All these labels are meaningless. Just to serve Hashem as best as you see fit. You have to make a decision. Which, if you tell me which community you want to live in, that's a good decision. Do you want to live in this community? Do you want to live in that community? Make a big chart. What are the pros and cons of each community? And every community has a big, big chart with a lot of pros and a lot of cons. And you see which pros you like and which cons you're not so scared of. And then you choose. But don't, God forbid, turn yourself into one of those people. It's such a mediocre substance. It's like becoming, I have my tea that I'm on a diet. I put in some sweet and low, some saccharin. It doesn't really taste so sweet, but it's a substitute. You don't want a substitute. You want the real thing. You want real substance, real tea, real sugar, not the sweet and low. Not these artificial substitutes. So it's important to have a historical perspective. It's important to say not just, how are people being from in the 21st century, and how can I be from like the people in the 21st century? But I go back and say, well, what did Frumkeit mean 100 years ago? What did Frumkeit mean 80 years ago? What was it like in Germany? What was it like in Spain? What was it like in Sibiu? What has this whole tradition given me? And that can make it a lot more substantive and authentic than just monkey seeing, monkey doing, what everyone around you is doing. It can make it, well, I really want to build myself. And there's been a lot of views and a lot of approaches and a lot of directions, and that's what Kalev has it, Yeshua doesn't. It's also true, guys, and please listen carefully to the second part of my statement, that some people are only identified with the past Jewish history. There's something about contemporary voices that make them contemporary. Here's a good line. Write this down. It's easy to be a ventriloquist with dead people. It's easy to make dead people say what you want them to say. Oh, the Rambam, he would have been modern Orthodox. It's such an intellectually bankrupt statement. I don't know whether he would have been or not, but he would have laughed at that statement for being intellectually bankrupt. You can try to take the Rambam and plug and play him into the 21st century. Like, I don't know, maybe the Rambam would have looked at the 21st century and says, my goodness, in the 21st century, I don't do anything else but learn Torah. I don't know. The Rambam lived in Spain in the 12th century. You're trying to plug and play him in the 21st century? That sometimes it's I'm not opposed to statements, it's just I'm humiliated to hear statements. They suffer such lack of intellectual honesty. Like, at least be honest. At least say something that makes sense. Right or wrong, but don't insult me with saying stupid, ideologically tainted statements just to win an argument. That's not going to gain any points in my mind. Just the makeups. I can be a demagogue also. I'm a pretty good demagogue. You can make up statements also. So it's always easier to say. Sometimes you'll see people. Okay, here's an example. You'll see an older person, and that person will say, well, I don't really, the world is becoming too religious for me. The world is becoming too right-wing for me. I don't know what right-wing is and left-wing, but whatever. Too religious. And my grandfather was a very, very religious man. And he, fill in the blanks. Okay, your grandfather lived 70 years ago. And 70 years ago, the state of religious orthodoxy was very different. And maybe he was a very religious man for his time, but he may not have known halacha because people didn't keep halacha as much as they do today. Or maybe he knew halacha, and he was a rabbi of a city. He just said, you know what, I can't. And someone once told me the following story. Okay? I know this is going to sound crazy to our non-Americans, but something really crazy happens in the New York area. I know, Joan, it's going to be a little strange for you also. In the New York area, right around now, is called a phenomena. And you know what they call it? It's an English word, but it sounds Yiddish. The phenomena is called the country. You guys know what the country is? The country is that there are probably, this is an incredible figure, probably close to, are you ready? 400,000 Orthodox Jews who migrate from the New York City metro area to go up to the Catskill Mountains for the summer, for 3-4 months. And it's like a pop-up world. Like all of a sudden, in the middle of nowhere, kosher food pops up, kosher shuls pop up, kosher. All of a sudden, you're walking through this beautiful mountain terraced area like Muscle Beach or whatever, and there are hundreds of thousands of Hasidim from Jews to go to the country. And there are camps and bungalows and country, and it's an amazing sociological phenomenon. It's really amazing. Moshe was pretty close to the country, so you can. Okay, so what was I talking about? How did we get to this? Anyone tell me a lifeline here? What are we talking about? Right, okay, thank you. Okay, so in the 60s, the country wasn't that popular, but people still went up to the bungalow colonies. Now, the following story in the 60s. Man went up to the country with his wife, into his bungalow colony, and he came back, he lived in Queens, and he was walking home from Shabbos with his wife and his kid. And all of a sudden, everyone's making like eyes at him, like looking at him, strange, making eyes at him. He feels like all these eye darts at him. He's like, why are you looking at me that way? He says, because you're pushing your carriage in a Rosh Hashanah. You're not allowed to push a carriage. No one had Arabs there. You're not allowed to push a carriage. He said, like, what does that even mean? Oh, so you weren't here for the summer. You were in the country. Over the summer, the rabbi told us, by the way, it's come time for me to teach you the laws of Rosh Hashanah and Shabbos. Because the rabbi realized that beforehand, it would fall on deaf ears. But now, in the arc of the community, he realized they're prepared to hear that this is Chilul Shabbos D'Oraisa. And you were in the country, so you didn't realize. So just be careful that you update yourself post-country. Yeah, 40 years ago, it was a battle to keep Shabbos. And 40, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, it was a battle to keep people from marrying non-Jews. So you know the best way to keep people from marrying non-Jews? Have dance night in the shul. And invite a big band. And have everyone putzing on each other physically in ways that are clearly usher. But it's a price that every normal person would pay if you feel that's going to keep people within the fold. But no one in his right mind today would go mixed dancing in that manner. when no one is right. Oh, my grandfather's a very, very religious person. I know, in the 40s, or in the 30s, or back, who knows? But now it's a different world. And it doesn't mean that we look back at people in judgment. We talked about this before. We look back at them with gratitude for keeping holding the fort and keeping religion intact. But that's the nature. Now we're discovering more things that we didn't discover before. And it's not always fanatic. We're discovering things we didn't know in the past and being able to introduce them into our community. So it is important to listen to contemporary voices in ways that historical voices can't comment. You don't know what the Rambam would say about one of Rav Amital's biggest updates is that as much as Rav Kook, in the last century, the early part of the 20th century, as much as Rav Kook spoke about the state of Israel and his vision for the state of Israel and his ideology about the state of Israel, all of a sudden two things happened that Rav Kook didn't see. A, the Holocaust. That's a pretty big game changer. I don't know how you're going to interpret the Holocaust, but whatever formula I have for Jewish identity and the return to Israel is going to be completely, completely overturned by the Holocaust. You can't ignore it. It's not just a variable you can delete. It controls the equation. And then also the state of Israel is formed, and not every secular Jew becomes religious overnight. Quite the contrary. They become really rabid anti-religious. And those are two things Rav Kook didn't live through. So as much as you can say that Rav Kook writing in the 20s was able to... And that's within 30, 40 years of Amital Feldman. 50 years of Kook's ideas have to be updated. So you have to be really, really careful, guys. Some people use history as a hedge against modern voices. Oh yeah, today's rabbis, they're all too fanatical, they're too religious, they're too machmir, I wish I had the Rambam here, That's so silly. And it's cowardly, and you can see people just running away. Yeah, if I'm a Rambam, I'm a Rambam man. He gave the middle road, a little from, not too from. Like, oh my goodness, I have to hear that once. A little from, not too from. No. There are modern issues and modern rabbanim and modern religious voices face those issues. You have to listen very carefully because you're sharing the sandbox with people who live in your period. And those are people who understand the cultural milieu and the ambience that you're setting. On the same token, it's important not to get stuck in a contemporary situation and think about, well, where have we gone? What? I'll just give you one example, okay? A textual example. You'll hear many people who will say, oh, we paskin like the Mishnah. Some people ask me, doesn't the Mishnah Berurah say you should wear a hat during davening? If the Mishnah Berurah says you should wear a hat during davening, so why do I wear a hat during davening? Now, as I've said so many times, I completely admire people who feel that wearing a hat in davening will increase their kavod tefillah. There's nothing wrong with that, but why don't I? Obviously don't think it increases my kavod tefillah, but the Mishnah Berurah says so. Well, first, the Mishnah Berurah lived in the early part of the 20th century and people still wore hats. Today, clowns wear hats or baseball, you know, sports people wear hats, but I don't feel putting a hat on my head announces. And some people say, no, that's exactly the point. You are different. So it's a very complicated, not complicated, but it's a layered conversation. I feel like my standards of honor are based on societal standards. So no, you try to separate yourself from society and give a uniform. But getting back to the issue, but forget what you're saying. The Mishnah Berurah says, the Mishnah Berurah of Lichtenstein would tell us, was never intended to be a Sefer Psak. The Mishnah Berurah was written because over the 400 years or so, a little bit less, 350 years, since the Shulchan Aruch was written as the final word in halacha. You can imagine if you're living in the 16th century, wow, we have the final word. You know, before the Shulchan Aruch, you had to go through the Gemara, the Rashba, the Ritva, the Tosva, and just open the Shulchan Aruch and it's right there. Until it isn't. Until you have tons of svarim written about the Shulchan Aruch and machloksim, what he meant in this case. And now, once again, 400 years of scholarship has scrambled the clarity of the Shulchan Aruch. So in 1570, open up the Shulchan Aruch, see what he says. But now it's 1870. And what did the Shulchan Aruch say? And what did the Shach, Taz, Magen Avram, No to Behuda, Pisrei Chubach, Sam Sofer, Bekiv Eger, Prima Gadim, what do they say? So once again, it's scrambled, as it should be, because not everything is simple. And to make matters more complicated, the world changed in 350 years. There's electricity, there's steamboats, there's medicine. So whatever Yosef Cairo wrote, even if he knew what his intentions were about every situation, there are new situations. So the Chafetz Chaim said, I'm going to write an anthology, and I'm going to collect all the positions and tell people what I think is the clearest position. There are two problems. A, he was a great writer. And great writers tend to have their works read more readily than poor writers. Here's a really, really good, hey, really the gift of writing. Certain people know how to write. Certain people don't. I can tell you, those people don't know how to write. It's really hard to read their Chiddushim. He writes, he is one of the best, probably one of the best Hebrew writers, Torah writers, in the entire millennium. He just really knew how to write. Number one, I'm a good writer in English. I'm a poor writer in rabbinic. And when I try to write rabbinic Hebrew, modern Hebrew, not so bad. But when I try, if I have to write the Mishnah, I can never do it, aside from the knowledge base. I have friends of mine that grew up with me in Yeshiva. They're much better writers in terms of how to write a Chiddushei Torah. My writing is, I write to myself, I'm more Hebrew. I'm getting better at it. So it's just the skill that you either have or you don't have. The other thing is, he's a big Talmid Chacham. He's the biggest Talmid Chacham of his generation. But he never said, no one ever got up and said, okay, he's writing a Sefer. When it comes out, we're all going to follow the Sefer, and that's going to be the Psak Halacha. Rav Lichtenstein told us that in his day, growing up, they would follow the Pri Chadash more. Now, Pri Chadash is harder to read. Most of you probably never seen a Pri Chadash. Over the last 100 years or so, the Mishnah Berurah has become the baseline for most halacha. So if you're looking for a Sefer to base your Psak on, most poskim today were based on the Mishnah Berurah. And I recommend to everyone to base it on the Mishnah Berurah. And I base my Psak when I have to look up something on the Mishnah Berurah. But just because the Mishnah Berurah says something doesn't mean, oh my goodness, how could you... Now, you don't make that decision easy. You say, oh, I believe that, you know, I don't follow Mishnah Berurah in this case, but being that I'm part of a community that made the decision that we're not going to wear hats during davening in Israel, because in Israel it's not going to reflect any kavod, I, the Mishnah Berurah, says it, because significant Rabbanim have gotten together and said, you know what, this is not part of our tefillah anymore. I didn't just wake up one day and say, oh, the Mishnah Berurah says it, but, you know, who cares? Chas v'shalom. So there really are two parts to this whole Kolev Yoshua dichotomy. One is, don't tell yourself you're not. What I'm trying to do in this classroom is take everything off the table, all the excuses, all the whatevers, all the who knows, and just give you a mirror. Okay, here's the mirror. Look at yourself in the mirror. You have potential. Hashem has expectations of you. Now go. Now make decisions. Don't say I couldn't, and don't say I shouldn't, and I can't, and I don't have it, and I don't have it within me. I'm just trying to make it clear. Can't make a decision for you, but I'm trying to make the decisions clear. Not to have any excuses. You're an outsider, you know what, so was I. Number one. Number two, in this complement distillation between Yoshua and Kalev, you've got a little bit of each. You've got Moshe looking at, Yoshua looking at the temporary voice, don't forget Mitzrayim. No one can know how Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov would have taken the Jews out of Mitzrayim because they lived 400 years earlier. But you have Kalev who says, you know, I want to feel my avos. And he goes to Hebron, and he gets inspiration from his avos. Okay. On that note, what time do we have? Well, we only have 10 minutes. Okay. So we'll skip on that note. We'll go to the next on that note. It's really important, I think, in life to have proportion. To be able to see things with perspective. And part of it is, this is Tchelis week, so I tell the Tchelis people, they put me on some list or something of people that wear Tchelis, or teaching Tchelis this week, or wrote about Tchelis, so I'm on the Tchelis team, so I want to make sure that everyone knows I wear Tchelis. They're making a big Tchelis push this week. I don't get any Tchelis commissions, so don't worry. No pressure here for the Tchelis sign up, but just a proud wearer of Tchelis. But that's really why Tzitzis is a memory jogger. Okay? That's what actually the article I published this week, so I'll put it on the list if anyone wants to see it. But how does tzitzis all of a sudden jog your memory for all the mitzvahs? What makes tzitzis so iconic? So you all know Rashi in Menachos. Well, tzitzis is a gematria of 600 and 5 knots and 8 strings, 613. Some of you may think that way. If you do, I urge you to become mathematicians, because everything you see is math. But most of us, unless we're told, and obviously Rashi tells us, it's got to be something more. So the more is what Rav Meir said. Gemara Menachos, I don't have time to read it with you, but Rav Meir said, you know how Tchelas and Tzitzis helps you remember all the mitzvos? If you look, it's on the back of page, blah, 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 page 2, it's in Gemara Menachos, source 7. Because you look at Tchelas and you see the color, and you immediately think about the ocean. Then when you think about the ocean, you immediately think about the sky, because they're both the same color, and they actually meet each other. The sky and the ocean meet each other at a little point called the horizon. And when you think about the sky, you think about the Kisei HaKavod. And you know what Techelos is? It's like going up in an airplane. Remember the last time you landed and you looked down at your street, your neighborhood, your city, and you saw these little boxes and little figurines and little cars and little stores, and you saw your life from a different perspective. And for a moment you said, well, in a quick moment you said, well, oh, wow. Because when you live your life, something called routine sets in and you just walk through. But when you see it from a different, that's why major events shake you. They could be tragic events, they could be happy events. They take you out of your routine and they make you think about, like Corona took us out of our collective routine, made us think a lot about life. Going up in a plane gives you proportion. You're seeing yourself from a different vantage point. Every time you sin, every sin is a lack of perspective. If I outline for you the wages of sin, what are the costs of sin? What are you getting? What are you giving up? You start crying. I say, really? Okay, I know that I need something right now. Fill in the blanks. I need to do this. I need to tell a lie. I need to look at something. I need to eat something. I need to behave in a certain way. I need. For whatever reason, physical, psychological, probably. A nice big physical, psychological sandwich, because all sin is a sandwich. But what are you giving up? Ah, come on. That's a pretty bad trade. Eternity? Everlasting? Forever? My olam haba? For a minute? What if I told you, I'll give you a drug, you'll smoke it, it'll be great. I mean, but you get cancer. Like, you toss it. Long-term, short-term, doesn't stack up. It's not worth it. Well, this is the ultimate long-term, short-term gamble. Problem is we forget eternity. We get caught in the moment. We get caught in the here and now. We get caught in the present. We get very narrow. We get very focused. It's right now. It's June 2nd. I need that. You're not thinking about the future. So tzitzis is meant to be a proportion restore. You think of the tcheles, you look at the sky, you think of the ocean, you think of a, you know what? It's not just about me right here. There's something larger at play. Something larger at play. One of the advantages of people with perspective and proportion is you don't get frightened too easily. Fright has a way of making you fear the minute, the moment. And you broaden things out and you say, you know what? Let's not get panicky. Parsha Shlach is a really good parsha to learn the difference between panic and precaution. Because no one expected the Meraglim to come back and lie. And they saw what they saw. And it was frightening. And it was daunting. But you can respond to frightening, daunting, difficult situations in life two ways. One is, okay, how will I solve this? How will I overcome this? Give it some time. Let me think about it a little bit. Or you can just be thrown into panic. And for the Meraglim, it's all just about panic. It's all just about panic. They're crying. Grown people crying. They're crying their eyes out. Grown people crying. Crying's not going to help. You'll find yourself hitting hard situations in life, and you'll find yourself crying. Immediately, you suffer hard trauma and hard loss, but you have to recover. Long-term crying is not going to solve it. Long-term, you're going to solve it. What can you do? Substantively, how can you make a change? How can you make a dent, even a small dent? Panicked people, their mind starts cycling, and they become obsessive in a way that can't help. And you see this panic in the case of the Meraglim, where they're saying, you know what? We heard the people talking about us. And they called us grasshoppers. No, you didn't. You didn't know what they were thinking. You're just projecting your own fear and your own sense of inadequacy into other people's minds. And you know, it doesn't make a difference what other people think about you. It doesn't make a difference what other people think about you. What do you think about yourself? Stop worrying about what people think about you or are saying about you. It's not in their head, it's in your head. It's not what they're saying about you and how they're viewing you. It's what you believe in yourself. And that's it. And that's where it starts and that's where it ends. But panic is a way of distorting and proportion as a way of re-equalizing and redistributing proportion. Famous story. Man leaves the city, 100,000 people, to go travel to the next city. He sees these two very, very conspiratorial looking people on the road to his city that he just left. And he said, well, where are you going? And these two people said, we're going to the city and we're going to annihilate the city. 100,000 people, how are you going to annihilate the city? So one guy says, hi, I want to introduce myself. My name is Plague. I'm going to kill 10,000 people. This is my friend Panic. He's going to take care of the other 90,000. Panic's always worse. Panic's always the accelerator. Panic's the jet fuel. Second you fall into panic, there's no solution. Everything goes south. Tires fall off. And panic is a chisar and a pneumonia. It's not just, I could give this conversation in a college and tell people not to panic, not to project their fears, and not to project their hatred, not to project their cowardice and proportion. But ultimately, the greatest proportion restorer is a Kodesh Baruch Hu and Emunah. And at a certain point, and you will have to go through this, hopefully not much, but hopefully the state of Israel will remain a safe place, and hopefully a Kodesh Baruch Hu will allow us to continue to solidify our presence here. But you will be called upon in your relationship to Israel, and this is at the heart of your relationship to Israel. There may be some rough patches ahead. There may be some difficult moments ahead. And if you're unable, vis-a-vis the state of Israel, to discern between panic and precaution, that is a chisaron in emunah, in your love for this land and your faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu about this land. Things get difficult here. Things get violent here. Precaution. How do I travel? Where do I travel? How do I come? Where are the cities that I should come? What are the travel restrictions? But if you say, oh, Israel, it's just a war zone, and I can't go there, and it's not for me, and I'm afraid, and people are shooting each other in the streets, and that's chisaron in faith, and you becoming a meragel, and your relationship with Israel is flawed. And I'm not just discussing theoretically. I'm discussing practically. I lived through the first intifada in this country. I lived through the second intifada. I lived through various wars and skirmishes. And not everyone's level of precaution is the same. It's a question of tonality. How do you speak? How will you speak at your table back home? Let's say you don't live in Israel, Chas V'Shalom. And let's say there is that war, skirmish, missiles. How will you speak? Will it be, oh, it's just a war zone, everyone's dying in panic? Or you say, okay, it's a difficult time. And maybe you'll decide not to go. But it'll be a different tone. When I lived in this city, through the second intifada in the early twos, my wife traveled every day to Yerushalayim with a bulletproof vest on and a helmet. And there were times I thought, I may not see her again. And some people left. I didn't judge the people who left. But it wasn't my job to move to Hebron. My life was in a lone spot. You know what my job was? To hold the line. And not to cave to panic, because that's all it is panic and terror. More people die from bookshelves in America. Bookshelves have fallen then. And the amount of people, unfortunately, were killed in this war. And trust me, when you tabulate all the people that were killed in this war and connect them to all the people across the world who were killed in violence, domestic violence, you know, the statistics aren't even close. You're far safer living in Israel than any place across. Just like you're far safer getting on a plane than you are getting to the airport to get on a plane. But it's just psychology. It's just the way you see things. And if you're able to just take the psychology out of the equation, take the emotions out of the equation, and just deal with real time. The safest year to live in Israel was the height of the Intifada. Because for all the unfortunate terror victims, fewer people travel the roads. And 7 times as many people get killed in road accidents than in terror. So on record, if you were living in 2003 or 2002 in the state of Israel, that was statistically, it's all statistics, the safest time to live in Israel. Because you weren't traveling that much. And fewer people were killed. So it's not my job to move to Hebron. One day you'll be living in Chutz La'aretz, let's say. It's not your job to say, oh, there's a war going on, I'm going to sell my house and move to Israel. That's not your routine. Maybe it should be. But your responsibility is, oh, I travel to Israel every summer, I'm going to Israel this summer. I send my kids to summer camp in Israel, I'm sending them unless the camps are closed, as they were during Corona. Whatever your routine is for this country, you have a moral and a historical responsibility not to walk back that routine and not to let terror get to you. And to find out the facts and to find out if people tell you, look, you can't come now, the airports are closed, not your fault. People say, don't come now. But that's not what people say. They'll say, come and stay here. Come and have the following routine. Come and behave that way. And that will determine whether you're panicked or proportioned. And that will determine whether you really have faith in the land of Israel. Good night, everyone.